What does your new research show as the main cause of that warming event?
You're right that hydrates, methane hydrates, or clathrates are also called. That was the most popular hypothesis. We can maybe talk about, if you like, later, you know, implications and not implications for the future. Also, people wondered whether there was a lot of organic matter on land that then got oxidized with this warming and helped amplify the event. We found it was more likely to be mostly driven by volcanism. So right at this time, the North Atlantic starts to rapidly rift apart. So Greenland is being moved away from the UK and Scandinavia. There are massive flood basalts. There are intrusions of magma into oil traps, into coal measures. There's a whole variety of sort of exciting sort of petrological and volcanological sort of things going on, all of which that could lead to the release of CO2 to the atmosphere.
And we've seen, though, that one major volcano erupting can cool the Earth for a couple of years. The eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 cooled it by about 1 degree Fahrenheit, I'm told. And in 1815, we had that Indonesian volcano dropping temperatures several degrees. So why would volcanic eruptions that you're talking about lead to global warming in the PETM?
So that's a good point. The sulfate aerosols that some volcanoes put up high into the stratosphere. So firstly, you need a very explosive eruption to push it. So sulfate aerosols lower down are no good. That's what sort of comes out of a lot of marine shipping at the moment. That just leads, at least today, to smog and not to necessarily cooling. You've got to put this stuff up about 30 or 40 kilometers into the atmosphere where the little particles reflect sunlight. But these effects don't last that long. So Pinatubo was a measurable sort of cooling for about a year or so. And then the sulfate aerosols basically eventually rain out on a time scale of a few years. Whereas we know if you put CO2 in the atmosphere, this is with us for, it has a range of time scales, but it's effectively with us for tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years.
So global warming gases come up out of those volcanoes from the depths of the Earth?
So that's one. So magma, the Earth has a lot of dissolved CO2 in the interior of the Earth. And so as you bring magma to the surface and it depressurizes, that CO2 can come out. So that's a basic effect of what volcanism can do with greenhouse gases. You can get magma up on the surface, but you can intrude magma horizontally, and these are called sills. And often the magma is pushing between different sorts of rock, which is maybe a weak layer there. And if it pushes, for instance, above or below a coal measure, then it's going to cook up that coal and it's going to release CO2 that way. So we see evidence of these sort of magmatic, horizontal magmatic intrusions contacting with coal measures around about the time of the PETM. We also see evidence for this sort of magmatic activity meeting basically fossil fuel reserves at the end of a period called the Permian, which is where almost all life died out. That was 251 million years ago.
Now, how did you work out that it was not thawing methane clathrates or hydrates that caused the great warming?
So this comes back to what a lot of my colleagues do with taking the sediment that's been drilled from the bottom of the ocean and trying to fish out these tiny, tiny, they're about 200-300 microns across, these little shells of zooplankton that were living close to the surface of the ocean back 55 million years ago. There's another element called boron. This goes into a lot of cleaning products and washing powders and detergents today. This also has two isotopes, and that ratio changes not like temperature, which oxygen isotopes we use for temperature, but for boron, the two isotopes change in their ratio as they're recorded in the foraminifer as a function of pH, so the acidity of the ocean. So my colleagues reconstructed basically how the pH of the surface ocean changed across this event. And then I used a computer model of the global carbon cycle to match that pH change to the carbon emissions. And the result was that the carbon emissions were much too large to be things like hydrates, at least not hydrates alone.
Now, considering how rapidly we're warming now, it is important to know how fast the warming was 56 million years ago. And along with Sandra Kirtland Turner of UC Riverside, you co-authored what I would call a companion piece in Nature Communications on August 25th, and the title is A Probabilistic Assessment of the Rapidity of PETM Onset. Can you give us a snapshot of what that article outlines?
So that other study, so this looks at some, we're back to these these tiny shells again of these zooplankton called foraminifera. That looks at some data, quite old data now, where people measured single shells, and they saw a lot of values. One of the proxies they measured was temperature, so they had a lot of values that were colder temperatures, so before this warming event. And then there appeared to be this sudden transition, or at least the next set of samples they measured all appeared to have the warm temperatures of during the event, or the peak of the event. And they didn't measure any what one could call intermediate values. So if you had a very, very slow warming, for instance, you would start measuring at the in the very deepest sediments, you would start measuring cold temperatures. And then if you had a very, very slow warming event, you would start measuring slightly warmer temperatures, slightly warmer temperatures, slightly warmer temperatures again in these oxygen isotopes until you eventually are measuring the peak warming temperatures. But that's not what was seen in this record. They had cold temperatures and then straight to hot temperatures. And so this was a sort of statistical model looking at how these shells might have been moved around in the sediments by a process called bioturbation and trying to come up with a probabilistic estimate of what is the chance, given a certain an assumed warming rate, what is the chance of not measuring one of these intermediate values.
So, Andy Ridgewell, in March 2016, you co-authored the paper published in Nature Geoscience titled Anthropogenic Carbon Release Rate, Unprecedented During the Past 66 Million Years. The review article by Turner et al. Says your newest paper this year found peak carbon emission rates during the PETM were less than a tenth of current fossil fuel emissions, and yet there was a warming of 5 degrees C. What does that tell us?
That's a difficult question in terms of there are two aspects of this whole thing. Firstly, I've actually been on a number of papers that have come to all sorts of conclusions about the rate of warming or the timescale for this event onset. And I think we still have very little constraints on whether it was, you know, between about 1 and 10 or so thousand years. We can do different techniques like this probabilistic assessment to come up with less than 3 or 4, but you can look at some other methods and maybe come up with 3 or more. So the first thing is it's a very uncertain estimate to make. Time is very, very difficult in geology other than the sort of very, very longest multi-million year sort of timescales. In terms of what we can learn about the future, what the relevance is, given that we're doing something so much faster. So let's say that we saw on a very slow warming, so across the PETM of 5 degrees, let's say we saw no extinction in polar bears. Now, polar bears probably haven't evolved by then. Does that mean that polar bears are safe today? We got a much faster warming, so it's difficult. It doesn't mean they're safe, and it doesn't mean they're not safe. That is one of the problems of drawing inferences from a slow event to a fast event. If we see a lack of impact, we can't rule that out for the future. Certainly, if we saw things happen at the PETM, we can say we will have it at least as bad in the future. I mean, one thing we do see is extinctions amongst some of these little shells in the deep sea. Whether anyone cares about in the future, I doubt it. But that does suggest that if we have some sort of extinction impact at the PETM, we should have that and more with a faster event in the future. Because no one cares about the deep sea, we do know that there was massive reorganization and disruption in terrestrial ecosystems, so we should expect something at least on that scale. There were actually good things from the PETM, so there was a big mammalian radiation, and things like horses basically evolved after the PETM. So warming can be a good thing, depending on whether the species that goes extinct or not.
Yes, and we hope not to be one of those species that goes extinct, and we don't know that yet. Okay, but my understanding is that the PETM warming began, as you said, when Earth was already ice-free at the poles. Isn't it likely that the energy required to melt Greenland and Antarctica could slow down the pace of warming at our time, despite emissions being much higher? I mean, it takes a lot of juice to melt that ice.
It does. Compared with the energy released by fossil fuels is a lot, but not compared with the free energy we get by trapping more infrared radiation that's trying to escape the Earth. I can't remember whether I've ever tried to do that back of the envelope calculation. It's an interesting question, whether if you were going to take the energy from the Earth's surface to melt all the ice caps over 10 years or 100 years, what would that represent in terms of a delayed warming or a reduced warming? I don't know, but it's not like putting ice cubes in your beer. It's not going to help us much, I think. It's in climate models, so the predictions within climate models include snow melt or snow not being formed, and some of them increasingly have a coupled ice sheet model, so they would account for whatever that slight energy balance change is, but it's not a lot, and it's not going to keep us cool.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock as we investigate what brought on the last big global warming event 56 million years ago. My guest is Professor Andy Ridgewell from the University of California. He's co-author of a new paper which says, basically, the volcanoes did it. And I'd like to note that this new science of the PETM was led by Dr. Marcus Gutjahr of the Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany. And I'm drawing from a commentary on this paper, Andy, that was published in Nature August 31st. You pointed me to it. The lead author is Katrin J. Meissner from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. The title is Volcanism Caused Ancient Global Warming. There's a cool graphic that helps compare the two scenarios of methane versus volcanism. Can the techniques you used pick up a big burst of carbon over a very short period, like decades, if seabed methane did in fact erupt? Okay.
So, I mean, the data we got so far is at the cutting edge of the mass spectrometric techniques, but the data are quite sparse in time, or if you like to think of the sediment core as distance, they're relatively sparse in terms of going up the sediment core. So things could be happening in between those data points that we don't know about. The same total carbon release over a timescale of X could be short bursts of carbon over much shorter intervals with a gap in between. We can't rule that out. We can certainly rule out that happened with short bursts and nothing in between, and it was all hydrates. So I didn't mention it earlier. So when we measured this proxy using the boron isotopes to try and reconstruct ocean surface pH, we also measured at the same time carbon isotopes. And carbon isotopes can be used to pinpoint the source of your carbon. So we're using boron isotopes to reconstruct pH, and from pH tell us how much carbon was released. And then we look at the carbon isotopes to tell us what sort of carbon. And the combination of those two proxies tells us it must be mostly volcanism. We could certainly have small bursts of methane, but the whole event has to be driven to satisfy both these proxy constraints, both these reconstructed records. The whole event, the event as a whole, has to be mostly volcanism.
Did this study add anything to our understanding of climate sensitivity?
Well, the model that I developed and used to calculate the global carbon cycle impacts and to take the data and come out with estimates of carbon release and also the source of that carbon is not a full climate model. So it does assume inherently that you know what climate sensitivity is. And we assumed about 3 degrees, which is about the median of what we're expecting today. So the modeling itself didn't really have a freedom to tell you what climate sensitivity might be. I mean, certainly given that we have estimates of the carbon release, and hence we have estimates of how much atmospheric CO2 rose, and we have independent estimates of how temperature changed, you could certainly make that calculation. The answer is about 3 degrees. But it's not something that we really wanted to try and make something of. So at least what we've done, without trying to say anything about climate sensitivity, seems consistent with a middle-of-the-road sort of IPCC consensus number.
Now, you mentioned seabed life having problems. How did the oceans and ocean life respond to that wave of carbon and gases descending from volcanic dust?
So because on almost any of the estimates of timescale you take, this event is 1,000 to many thousands of years long in terms of the warming completed, the ocean, at least in the model and some proxy data suggests there were changes in ocean circulation, but the deep ocean will warm not much lagged compared with the surface. What we're doing today is very unusual. It's a very rapid surface-driven warming. And what happens then, it's like a little bit like a lake in summer. You tend to stratify the surface. You shut down ventilation temporarily. So today and continuing into the near future, we're stratifying the ocean. You reduce the nutrient supply to phytoplankton. You can sort of induce all sorts of biogeochemical changes and ecological changes probably at the PTM, because the warming seems so much slower, it was not so drastic in terms of ocean circulation. So at the bottom of the ocean, probably saw warming, maybe decreased pH as the thing that caused some of the extinctions.
And we're concerned too, Andy, about ocean acidification. Did that happen in that long ago warming event?
Well, in terms of just ocean pH itself, that's exactly what happened, because that's what we've reconstructed with these boron isotopes in these tiny foraminiferal shells. But what, in the modern ocean, what a lot of organisms seem to care about, and we care about corals, and so coral reefs become a big thing, corals are much more susceptible to not the ocean pH directly. This is where it all gets into miserable chemistry, into a part of the carbonate system called the carbonate ion. To cut a long story short, in a very short warming event driven by CO2 release like we're doing now, pH declines. Some organisms may be affected by pH. This carbonate ion species declines in concentration. This is what corals care about today and may be impacted by. If you go to a very slow carbon release, it turns out that those two things get decoupled. You see the pH change, and this is what we record, but the carbonate ion doesn't necessarily change very much. So it's a different sort of ocean acidification. If you think of ocean acidification only in terms of pH, yes, we have ocean acidification. If you think of ocean acidification as the total change to the carbonate system in the ocean due to releasing CO2, then it's very different at the PTM because of the relative slowness of the event.
And was this great event that happened 56 million years ago, was it also a mass extinction event on land?
So I'm not a terrestrial ecological expert. There were many disruptions, many range shifts because of the warming, probably allowing species to mix across the Arctic. There were actually mammalian radiations, and actually sort of you could look at it, evolutionary positive things that came out of it. It may be that we don't have the records really to nail down extinctions on land. We're much more familiar with, funnily enough, we're much more familiar with these organisms that are 200 microns across. The record tends to be much more complete, and I guess we focus on the complete records with good timescales first.
And how long did those higher temperatures last, Andy?
Probably of the order of about 100,000 years, which is a typical lifetime of CO2. So if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, the warming will last on the timescale of 100,000 years.
Now, a couple of scientists have suggested that it may be relatively good news to find out that volcanic activity caused the last great warming instead of methane clathrates or permafrost melting. Why?
And I think you could say they're right. So certainly when a lot of us were thinking a while ago that maybe it was things like hydrates. So we always knew the PTM, it needed some sort of trigger. And then what a lot of the thinking was that what we were seeing was positive feedbacks involving an initial warming, maybe destabilizing methane hydrates, the methane causing more warming, maybe this warming also causing oxidation of organic matter in peatlands and carbon stores on land. And so this event did originally look like it could have been a smallish trigger with lots of positive feedbacks driving more and more warming. And the implications of that would be, might we not have this in the future? We know we have hydrates in the ocean today. We know we have lots of carbon in permafrost. We have carbon in wetlands. And so I think the concern originally was, or a concern was, if we had such a strong, it's called a feedback, if we had such a strong positive feedback between warming and carbon release at the PTM, maybe this is what we'll end up triggering in the future. So if it's largely volcanism, which is what we concluded, you can rule out such a strong feedback back then, although you can't necessarily rule such a strong feedback out now starting from a cold climate state.
Yeah, I wonder what the crowd at the Arctic Methane Emergency Group will make of this. Have you had any of the scientists who considered methane the prime cause of the PETM commenting on your new science?
Not yet, not to me. So I'm not the first author of the study, so I let the first author take all the incoming.
The heat, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I'm wondering, Andy Ridgewell, what are some of your other interests, both personally and as a scientist?
Cats. Writing bad computer code. Scientifically, I'm interested actually in all of science. So writing computer models, learning to code and write computer models, actually gives you the option to look at all sorts of things. If you can write some sort of computing numerical representation of a system, then you can look at it. I have tended to focus on the global carbon cycle, but in writing models that you can put new things in, different things, I can look at all sorts of different time periods. I've looked at geoengineering. I've had students who've looked at, funny enough, putting sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it makes a cooling. Whether we should do it is, I think the mistake often is to think you can solve everything with a single solution or a single idea. There is this concept which has been around for a while in terms of climate mitigation called wedges. No one doesn't replace their incandescent light bulbs with LED bulbs because it's not going to solve the entire climate problem. You know it's a small part of the piece. So you change your mode of transport, you use more energy-efficient devices. My personal view is I'm not adverse to a little bit of geoengineering if it's part of a, you know, if it gets us there in terms of mitigating climate change or reducing climate change.
I suppose one of my questions would be, you've looked into this great warming event and a good many other things. What are your feelings about the direction we're heading now? I mean, for example, you mentioned 3 degrees. That's, I believe, the figure if we double the carbon from pre-industrial levels. I've seen people discussing a lot more than that, including scientists. There was the 4 degrees and beyond conferences, two of those. So what is your general take about the direction we're going?
I was optimistic before the price of oil plummeted beneath 100 and then beneath 50. And I'm still waiting for, I had hoped we were meant to have hit peak oil a while ago, but we clearly haven't done. So one thing that could have been helping us, but it just hasn't panned out that way with oil shale and things like that, is just the price of oil being at a value. It's meant to be something like $150 or so a barrel, long enough that basically it's just more profitable to do renewable energy. You know, at some point, as long as fossil fuel energy is sufficiently expensive, no one wants to lose money on their coal-burning power station. Everyone switches to renewables because that's how you make money. So it's unfortunate to be thinking about future climate change with oil at a current rate that's like 40 or whatever it is now. It seems like suddenly we're back to pessimism days of we're going to keep burning it. I'd like to think we head back up to 100, 150, and then we start seeing a further push towards renewables and everyone driving electric cars and things.
Well, there is that bright light. I believe the UK and several other governments have set a date beyond which they just aren't going to allow fossil-burning cars on the roadways, for example. But there's so much more to the whole system than that. We've got carbon coming out of agriculture, carbon coming out of everything, it seems like.
And at some point, you'll probably see it mandated from the White House that everyone has to have a coal-burning car, probably, at this rate here.
Maybe we'll leave it there. The coal-burning car, I'm all in favor. Okay, we've been talking with Dr. Andy Richwell from the University of California, Riverside. He's co-author of an important new paper in the journal Nature titled Very Large Release of Mostly Volcanic Carbon During the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum. And you can find links to the articles I've talked about here, plus more science journalism about this paper, in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Andy, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks, my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's not forget, most of the already dire predictions still do not include the soil carbon feedback. Our guest in December 2016, Thomas Crowther, explained it.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now, to be clear, in this paper, when you discuss 1 degree C of warming over 35 years to 2050, are you assuming 1 degree above pre-industrial temperature of the planet or 1 degree hotter than we are now?
That would be 1 degree hotter than we are now. But that's not what we're predicting. That's the most sort of recent ensemble member of the Earth system model suggests that soil temperature, surface soil temperature, is going to go up by 2 degrees by that time. So it's closer to an order of magnitude of 55 petagrams by 2050. We'll be lost from the carbon.
Can you please explain why the effects of a given amount of warming are never fully realized?
So ultimately, the process is always acting in response to warming. So the warming takes place, and then it's within the next couple of years that ultimately the total extent of carbon emissions takes place. So it's never an immediate process. And so it's almost like the changes in carbon emissions are always following the changes in warming.
Okay. So since more carbon from soils will increase warming, we call this a positive feedback loop. Are there control factors which can slow or halt this extra carbon release from the soil?
Certainly. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that changes to agricultural practices, things like holistic management of grazing animals or, you know, the use of biochar or organic products, can lead to massive scale carbon sequestration. And this has the potential to dampen the feedback that we're talking about here. And, you know, if done on a global scale, I think it has a really good, a strong chance to put a major dent in the magnitude of these carbon losses.
Now, media reports say this added soil carbon could be equal to adding another United States in terms of emissions. I had a question about that. Does that mean 1 year of U.S. emissions could come from the soil by 2050, or that every year soils could release the same amount as the United States does now?
So I think the article that highlighted that was suggesting that it would be every year the soils will emit as much as the United States is doing now. I think it was calculated more roughly, though, based on we estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions, well, expected anthropogenic emissions over that time. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit almost as much, well, about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
It's like adding a new giant industrialized country just because of this new knowledge. Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, you know, of course I want to understand the world, and if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for potentially for humanity. You know, it's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
That was Dr. Thomas Crowther from the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, as broadcast on Radio EcoShock on December 14th, 2016. You can find all our past shows for free as downloads in the archives at ecoshock.org, and you'll find my notes on this week's interviews with V. Ramanathan and Andy Ridgewell in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Check it out.
Radio EcoShock.
We're out of time for this show and for climate action a few years from now. It's well past now or never. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.
You're listening